Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C. June 20th is a day dedicated by the UN as the World Refugee Day. The UN describes a refugee as someone who has been forced to leave their country due to various reasons, including persecution, war, or violence. The UNHCR, the agency whose mandate is to coordinate international action to protect refugees and resolve refugee problems worldwide, says that over 65 million people around the world have been forced from their homes. The agency says that among that figure, the 65 million figure, among them are nearly 22.5 million refugees. It is estimated that sub-Saharan Africa is home to over 3 million refugees, many of them coming from countries such as Burundi, South Sudan, Somalia, Nigeria, and many others. And these countries have witnessed some form of conflict, often violent in nature. These conflicts force thousands of people to seek refuge in neighboring countries, and some of the host countries that have resettled thousands of refugees over the past two decades and continue to do so include Ethiopia, Uganda, Rwanda, DRC. And even though war and conflict are the primary reasons why people flee their homes, there are other reasons why people are forced to leave their homes. And these include extreme weather conditions like prolonged droughts and changing climate patterns that threaten their livelihoods, and many other factors. Now, the 1951 Refugee Convention says that once a refugee enters the territory of a state party to the convention, they should be granted protection from any threats to their physical safety. And the convention also says that refugees should receive at least the same rights, including freedom of thought, of movement, freedom from torture and degrading treatment. And it goes without saying that they should also receive food and shelter. And that's the primary reason of agencies like the UNHCR and other state and non-state actors. However, reports show that in many host countries, refugees complain that they face a lot of restrictions, including their ability to move around freely. So as we commemorate World Refugee Day, we want to look at some of the issues that affect refugees around the world. And we want to talk about your role, because we know we all have a role to play in contributing to a world where refugees feel safe, and most importantly, to a world where people will have no reason to flee their homes. This is Upfront on the Voice of America.
Like now, what is ongoing in South Sudan, we the people who are staying in refugee camp, we don't understand. People are talking of fish. And when you, in the morning, you hear someone has been killed.
Oh, I'm by name called David Joseph. As a refugee, the most challenges I'm facing at home mostly. One, as I came from South Sudan here in the camp, I am a student actually. I am in S3. And the most thing that I'm facing is only that there is no school. Living as a refugee is a must, sometimes it's a sign of the youths as me, things like employment. Let me talk of employment, it is not there.
I've been a refugee in Uganda for the last 17 years. Being a refugee, it's something that I don't really enjoy doing it. I would love to thank the Uganda government for giving us that freedom. Today, as a refugee, I'm able to work for my people through the organization freely without any interference. As long as I have that refugee identity, I have all rights to anything as a Ugandan.
You're just joining us. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Welcome. Now, a new report shows that Uganda faces one of the world's largest and fastest growing refugee crises. This is mainly due to the influx of South Sudanese fleeing the conflict in their country. Over 1.5 million South Sudanese are seeking asylum in the region, but Uganda hosts a bulk of them. Figures are around 700,000 and more coming this year. A report from the organization Refugees International contends that while no emergency response is perfect, the Ugandan government and aid agencies in the region need to be given credit for receiving South Sudanese refugees in what they say is a dignified and protective manner. And in the studio with me, I have two authors of the report, Michael Boyce, whose particular focus is on peacekeeping and protection of civilians in situations of forced displacement, and Francisca Vigo Walsh, a senior advocate for women and girls. Both of them are with Refugees International. Welcome to you both.
You're here to talk to us about this new report that your organization has commissioned, just released this past week. What is the gist of the report?
How I would summarize the report is that on the one hand, we are facing just an enormous refugee crisis coming from South Sudan into Uganda right now. This is one of the fastest growing refugee crises that we have in the world today. Mm-hmm. 2,000, 4,000, 7,000 people sometimes fleeing every day into northern Uganda because of ongoing violence in Sudan, because of the economy, which is cratering, because of food, which is increasingly scarce. So on the one hand, we have a massive crisis which does demand that the world respond. But I think the second thing that's important to stress is that contrary to so much of the bad news that we hear about refugees these days, contrary to the kind of hostility that we are hearing in so many areas against refugees, the lack of empathy with their plight, Uganda has done a really incredible job. It has shown incredible generosity in accepting these people, in giving them land where they can settle, where they can feel safe, in letting aid agencies come in and provide services, etc. So Uganda is really, really stands out at this point in time as an extraordinary, generous host of refugees, and a country that, you know, a lot of other countries in the world should try to emulate.
So Uganda has, I guess, progressive refugee policies, one of the few in that area, in that neighborhood. This report specifically talks about South Sudanese refugees coming into Uganda. Where else are they going? Because it's over 1.5 million refugees that have come in so far, and more. Uganda has only 700,000. You're projecting that they will have much more, you know, later on during the year. But where are the other refugees? Which areas are they going to?
Well, I believe that we are seeing a flight of South Sudanese refugees to all neighboring countries, including Uganda, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, including Sudan and Kenya.
Now, reports say that there are more displaced persons today than at any other point in human history. Like we said earlier in the show, most people are displaced from their homes because of conflict, environmental disasters, and other reasons. And in East Africa, Uganda, a country where I was born as a refugee, figures show that Uganda hosts over 1.2 million refugees in 28 settlements around the country. And this week, Uganda will host what it calls a solidarity summit on refugees. I reached Ambassador Arthur Kafero, a director in Uganda's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and asked him about what lessons that the world needs to learn from his country on how to handle refugees.
So we're looking forward to international community getting a better sense of the Ugandan model, how we support refugees in this country.
What is it that your government has done that makes it a good host country for refugees? What is it that the world should learn from Uganda in terms of how they handle the refugees that come to your country?
The approach that Uganda has taken is basically to open doors to refugees. So Uganda is a place where refugees can always find a place to go. But when refugees come to Uganda, they have opportunity to work. They're able to get land. They're able to go to school. And they're able even to get employment. The Ugandan approach is something that they have had for many years, over 50 years right now. The refugees, both coming from the region, but even outside the region, normally find Uganda a place where they can come and stay.
What is the Ugandan government looking for from the international community in terms of support?
The support that we need, that we're looking for, is part of a comprehensive refugee response framework. It is consistent with a declaration that was adopted in NEO. And we are hoping that significant new funding will be mobilized. We have the immediate humanitarian needs of the refugees, but also investments that need to be made to support the host communities. Because here in Uganda, the refugees are not camps. They stay in settlements. And many times, even the land where they get land is out of the generosity from host communities. So we need to have those investments in particular social infrastructure to make sure that the host communities are not overburdened by the generosity which they show to refugees who come into their area.
Ambassador Arthur Kafero, a director in Uganda's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Now, as the world marks World Refugee Day, there were news that hundreds of refugees drowned in the Mediterranean as they crossed from the Libyan coast going to Europe. Reports say that this year already, over 1,000 people have died drowning on that journey. And this is a record high. And activists say that part of the tragedy is that people are getting desensitized to the death of African refugees, to the point that many of the deaths go unreported, and governments that have the power to do something about it are not acting to protect the lives of these migrants. From Minnesota, I reached Lula Saleh, an Ethiopian Eritrean American activist and artist. Her widely viewed poem asks the question, how many more?
I had just been reading a lot about the refugee crisis over the years, and especially for me, being Eritrean and Ethiopian and in the diaspora, it's just kind of, it's an issue that's very personal to me and just close to my heart. My parents are, obviously immigrants. I'm an immigrant. And while we weren't necessarily refugees according to the definition, that the UN has, it's sort of, with Africans, it's very ambiguous because for a lot of us, we are fleeing unstable situations. And while we might also be economic migrants, that's very much connected to issues of war and political instability, So it's definitely an issue that's, that I'm just passionate about and that is very personal for me and my community. And the Horn of Africa in particular has just in the last few years has been, I would say, probably the most affected on the continent in terms of this refugee crisis, with a majority of African refugees coming out from Somalia, Eritrea, some from Ethiopia, and then as well as, Nigeria. So there's a lot going on right now on our continent in regards to this.
You obviously took this interest much later on in your life as you've grown. Did you ever have conversations with your parents about their journey from Eritrea, Ethiopia, coming to the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so because for us, we actually were in Saudi Arabia before we came here. So I grew up hearing, especially my mom's stories about what she experienced being a migrant in Saudi Arabia, so not even in the U.S. And all the stories you hear about domestic workers and, the way in which Ethiopian women and Eritrean women are treated there as maids and, domestic servants and stuff. And my mom was one of those people, 20, 30 years ago. So it's, again, even with time, the issue is still present. And it's crazy to me that 30, 40 years later, this stuff is still happening around the world, And then I also like my dad's story, too, where he also migrated by foot, and he had to go through Sudan. So definitely and I have cousins, I have aunts, uncles. I mean, my whole family, I could say, has been displaced either because of just chronic instability or just because of the way our region is, unfortunately, right now.
You are in Minnesota right now, a state mm-hmm. where thousands, I believe, of refugees are resettled by the U.S. every year. Have mm-hmm. you interacted with any refugees in your area?
Yeah, actually, I was reading about this just now to prepare for the interview, but apparently it says over the last three decades, more than 95,000 refugees have come to Minnesota.
That's a lot of of refugees.
We have one of the largest, actually, in the country.
Refugee populations in the U.S.
One of the largest refugee populations, yeah.
Okay. Do you ever interact with them? What type of conversations do you have with them, and what kind of issues do they face as refugees in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, of course, because, especially in the Twin Cities, we just have such a huge migrant refugee population that it's kind of just normal, you know, and I would say a majority of refugees here are Somali and Hmong, and the Hmong are a stateless group that live in, I believe, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam, and so absolutely, I mean, we interact all the time. And the work that I do right now is with African immigrant communities. So we're always having conversations about identity and culture and what does it mean to be African and Black in this state, you know, in this country at this time and in this political climate. And also, I think what's cool about here, the Twin Cities in this moment, is that there's a lot of conversations coming together about refugee immigrant identity and also Blackness. Because both identities here are being very hyper-policed and hyper-profiled, especially if you're looking at the Somali community, which is Black, immigrant, refugee, Muslim, African. You know, they're all of these things. Mm. And so we definitely have had a lot of politics around it, but also a lot of really good conversations, too.
Okay. Now, many refugees that I've spoken to, African refugees in different parts of the U.S. are saying that the social infrastructure does not necessarily, they don't feel welcomed in a way, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you see in your area?
Yeah, I think I can see that because I think it's like that tension between, you know, I mean, are we African-American? Are we really African anymore because we're not on the continent, you know, are we really American because we aren't accepted obviously by America, but yet this is our country. So absolutely there, I feel like we're constantly negotiating where we belong and how we fit in. And I feel like it's not unlike maybe what Caribbean immigrants also experience or like Afro-Latinx immigrants probably experience, just like not really fitting into one category neatly, and so I definitely see that here. And I feel like because there has been more, just more representation in culture and in media, I do feel like that's shifting slowly. And again, like that's where I feel like the power of art is really important and why I'm trying to tackle this issue through my art is that by creating a different narrative or just by creating a different, you know, representation, you can impact culture and you can impact discourse. And hopefully that can continue to open up and push space so that people feel like, wow, I'm actually represented and I do belong. Like I do belong in this society because here I am in this piece of art or here I am in this music video. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So I'm really hoping to do more. More music and like spoken word videos that speak to my lived experience and my cultural identities. Because for me, I was personally growing up, and I moved to the U.S. 10 years ago, so I was pretty grown up when I came here. Right. But still, being a young person, it was kind of hard because I didn't really see anyone in positions of leadership or even like arts,
like yourself,
arts and culture, like myself.
Right.
Yeah. So I feel like I don't want to say I'm one of the first, but it's
you're kind of breaking new ground
common.
In a way. In some ways, you're breaking new ground and you're kind of a pioneer. The kind of a response that I got from when we posted your video was the same attitude that, you know, this is kind of new and we're happy to have such voices raising these issues. So I'm glad that you've, you know, you're dedicating your life to this. And I wish you the very best of luck, Lola. I've known you for a while now, and I'm very proud of what you're doing, and I'm happy for you too.
Thank you so much.
You're
that
welcome.
That is so kind. you got me feeling a little emotional. Thank you. I really sincerely appreciate that, because I've known you for, you know, quite a few years now, so I feel like you've seen my process and my growth. So thank you so much.
Welcome back to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Now, since 2013, South Sudan, Africa's youngest nation, has been embroiled in a civil war with thousands dead and millions displaced. A UN report says that more than 3 million people have been forced into displacement camps. That figure is estimated to be around 2 million people, and over a million others have crossed borders to seek refuge in neighboring countries of Uganda, DRC, Ethiopia, and others. But the current wave of refugees from South Sudan is not something new. Since the 80s, there has been a perpetual war and conflict, with millions of people often having to leave outside the country as refugees. And one of those people is my colleague Ayen Bio, a young reporter here with the VOA South Sudan project. Ayen tells me about the long, harrowing journey her mother took from South Sudan to the Gambela refugee camp in Ethiopia, and finally settling in the U.S.
We've been in constant war. Mm-hmm. At first, we were fighting the North. We finally got our independence in 2011.
And now there's fighting. So there's been a constant stream of refugees.
Exactly.
Some leaving, going back, and others coming back out.
Exactly. So there definitely is a generational presence of people there. There's kids who were born there, got married there, and still live there, which is unfortunate.
Which
but
is
that's
like
a reality.
The situation, say, in the Dadaab camp in Kenya,
exactly.
Or in Aki Valley in Uganda, where I was born myself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you even remember how it was? So you left as a baby?
I don't. You know, it's interesting. I was born in Gambela, and then soon after I was born, we went to Kakuma, in Kenya.
In Kenya.
And I don't remember too much of Kakuma, because it's when I was about 2 years old. We moved into the city, into Nairobi.
When you were 2 years old.
When I was about 2 years old.
You really don't have any recollections of whatever happened or your movement. Do you ever talk to your parents about how they traveled from Gambela to Kakuma, or how they traveled from South Sudan to Gambela?
Yeah, and my mom has told me very harrowing accounts of her journey to basically just give birth to me safely. There was at one moment she had to cross the Nile, and there was she was on a ship, and there's airplanes above them flying, dropping
like
bombs.
Fighter jets.
And so everyone had to basically evacuate the ship and go into these waters had alligators.
Right.
Exactly. So my mom had to swim to safety. Well,
right.
thank God she did.
Absolutely. And so we hear all these harrowing stories of migrants or refugees or people trying to flee from conflict, but dying in the process. You know, I think in the Mediterranean, already this year, 2017, we're in June, and we have over reports of over 1,800 already dead in the Mediterranean,
in the sea,
crossing from Libya and other coastal areas, trying to escape and go to Europe.
And you have to ask yourself, how dangerous is your home country if you're willing to risk your life crossing the sea?
Absolutely.
To get to safety.
So your mother survived those type of ordeals along the way, those experiences, life-threatening experiences along the way, and had you as a baby in Gambela. You moved to Kakuma as a two-year-old. When did you move to the U.S.?
We moved here when I was 8 years old. Before I get to that, let me just say that when we finally moved into Nairobi, we were still considered refugees, but we were able to rent an apartment, and I had a really great childhood in Nairobi.
Mm.
I had no idea that I was a refugee. I honestly had no idea.
You never felt like you were a refugee?
I never felt.
I imagine as a young kid, you're probably kind of insulated from the problems or the issues that your parents were going through.
Yeah,
they were,
I mean,
protecting you, but your parents must have felt like refugees.
No, they absolutely did, and there were certain hints that I remember very clearly when I was 7 or 8 years old in Nairobi. I could sense that my parents had a fear of authorities, and I remember one time in particular. We were in our apartment in Nairobi, and we heard a knock on the door. And, you know, it's a very distinct knock, so you knew that it wasn't a friend or anything. And my parents got really scared. And they asked all of my brothers and sisters to basically hide. My skin is lighter than my family members, so my mom said, you know, go answer the door, tell them that your parents aren't home. I just did what I was told, you know, not understanding what was going on. I later found out that those people were making sure that there weren't too many South Sudanese in one household. And my mom told me that because my skin was lighter, I could pass for a Kenyan. And they wouldn't bother us again.
So they put you at the front.
They did. Can you imagine, 6 or 7 years old, just doing that? But at the time, I felt the pressure, but I didn't feel it. To the extent where it really impacted my childhood. Mm. My childhood in Nairobi was honestly as every childhood should be. Mm. I remember going outside
playing
in the morning.
With your neighbors.
Yep, coming back.
Were there,
you know,
other South Sudanese children?
There were. Mm. There were a few. So, you know, I mean, it was great. And eventually, I got into school. So it was. It was a really nice childhood. When we came to the U.S. in 1995, that completely shifted.
So you moved to the U.S. as an eight-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel any difference? Did you see any difference?
I did.
As an eight-year-old?
Almost,
what kind of difference?
Almost immediately. So I assumed coming to the U.S. that my life would become even better, because before we moved here, everyone said, it's a land of opportunity. You know, it's... They made it feel like Disneyland, to use American slogan, and it wasn't that. As soon as we got here, my parents became really restrictive. We weren't allowed outside to play, which confused me because, like, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Nairobi playing with my friends from the morning, you know, all the way until dusk. So I didn't understand that.
Mm.
But my parents became a lot more protective, and it took me years to figure out why. And it surprised me once I learned, but I realized that my parents were actually afraid of America. They were afraid of what might happen to their child if she's not watched over.
I guess it was a whole new experience for them, too.
It was.
You know, even though they were grown up, this is not Africa. This is not Kenya or South Sudan or Ethiopia, where there'd been refugees previously. That's
exactly.
The continent and the people they are aware of. But I guess America kind of,
the
social, was that shock.
The social dynamic completely shifted for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, it's I'm
they,
still
they
trying.
They spoke English, I imagine.
My father spoke English.
Your mom, not so much.
My mom didn't speak a word of English.
Wow.
So she had to learn. And, you know, obviously.
Did you speak any English?
I did not. I spoke Swahili, Arabic, and Dinka, but I didn't speak any English at all. And, you know, for my mom especially, it was hard because once we came here, the government gave us 6 months until we had to be completely independent. And obviously, you know, you and I know living in America, both the mom and the dad need to
work.
It's hard
to be able to find that independence in 6 months when you have a family.
Exactly. And when you don't know English.
Yes.
When you can't drive.
There are all these different layers.
Right.
Right, overcome.
Right, absolutely. And for my mom especially, it was hard because she didn't know the language. You know, so simple things like getting us to school. Well, who's going to do that? Because our dad's at work,
mm-hmm.
and my mom can't drive because my mom can't read and write. So my mom, and I'm really, really proud of her, but she learned English. You know, it took her a couple of years, but she learned English. She got a job, mm-hmm. and she was supporting us. But that transition from living in Nairobi, where she didn't have to work, to coming to the U.S., you know, and all she's really known
right.
is conflict and war, and she spent most of her life being a refugee.
And so shout out to Ayen's mom if you're listening to
shout
this.
Shout out
you
to
know,
my mom.
Respect all the mothers who have to
she's
do whatever
incredible.
They have to do for
yeah.
their children as refugees. They're navigating these new terrains and territories and situations and experiences, and every day have to sacrifice
And so Ayeni's mom, my mom is also one of them. So I, you know, shout out and much respect to them. So, you know, we want
to... I have to say, refugee mothers have a special type of resilience that I haven't seen.
Thank you, Ayen. That's Ayen Bio, a reporter with VOA South Sudan Project. You can follow Ayen on social media. Her Twitter handle is Ayen, A-Y-E-N, underscore Grace. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. I want to thank all our listeners and our guests and all of you who contributed to the show in your opinions. We had some of the voices of young refugees, South Sudanese refugees in Kampala, Uganda. If you want to connect with us, remember to check us out on our Facebook page, keywords Upfront Africa Show. You can also connect with me on Twitter at Upfront Africa. My name is Jackson Bunganyi. Goodbye. This is VOA.